Not Quite Right features discussions that are unfiltered and uncensored and may include themes that are inappropriate for younger listeners. Also, I swear a lot.
Something doesn't seem quite right.
Welcome to Not Quite Right. My name is Ed. And this is the 11th of a series of interviews that Amanda and I recorded at the Words and the Waves Writers Festival this year. This time, we're speaking with Gideon Haig. Gideon is a journalist, podcaster, and above all, a massive cricket fan. He's the author of more than 50 books, including, most recently, the memoir My Brother Jazz. We spoke with Gideon about the experience of writing a memoir, as well as his deep love of the game of cricket. So, please enjoy our conversation with Gideon Haig. So we're here at Words on the Waves, and we're here with Gideon Haig.
Nice to be here.
So you're about to go on a panel discussion called Bloodlines. Tell us about that panel discussion.
I think I'm on with Leg Blaine, and Dominic Knight is the interlocutor. I think it's about memoir. I think both Leg and I have written stories about our family and about how families dealt with trauma and dislocation. Can't be many families that don't have some sort of traumatic incident in them, but they all tend to deal with them in isolation. They all tend to solve them according to their own lives. And in my own family's case, it's to do with the death of my brother 37 years ago, which was a subject that had not really been discussed in my family. It was one of those sort of taboos, those silent, sensitive areas. And I decided at last to write a book about it, a short book, not even a book really, a sort of an essay. And it's turned into a little pamphlet called My Brother Jazz. So not a book I ever sort of foresaw writing, but one that I feel glad to have written.
I think that's a hugely shared experience with many people, that these traumatic incidents are the things that nobody talks about, despite the fact that they are completely formative and in some ways, you know, can be the source of much breakdown.
Yes.
And yet we can't talk about the elephant in the room kind of situation.
Well, I was very resistant to thinking or talking about it too. I mean, my family is very, very small and very stoic.
Mm.
So always been about soldiering on in the face of unpleasant experiences. So even though the writing of the book only took me about 72 hours,
wow,
it was 37 years of not writing about it that I did most of the work in.
Mm. And with a book like that, I imagine much of the work is just coming to an understanding about what has happened, as opposed to necessarily the words on the page. It's about, well, what does it all mean?
Processing your emotions, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, but I don't think you actually do process your emotions, not completely, until you actually set about trying to create some sort of kind of artifact.
Mm.
I'd spent 37 years of basically very, very circular thoughts that never really had an outlet, that never really had an end point.
Cool.
So in a sense, the writing of it was about trying to short circuit that process to create it, to put it in some sort of permanent form whereby I could move it to one side.
Did it work?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, I think so. I was sceptical of that, and I've always had a bit of a thing about memoirs. It's not a genre that I feel particularly comfortable with. I don't like the idea of it doesn't come naturally to me. It feels self-indulgent. It feels a little bit look at me.
Yeah.
It's not something that came naturally to me.
Which is not at all, from the sound of it, the, you know, vibe of what you're trying to create there.
No.
It's not about you at all, really, is it? It's shared experience.
Yes, it is. I mean, it wasn't as though I had anyone else's experience in mind when I was writing. I don't think it was a supremely selfish gesture of me to sit down and do this. But it has had a very strong response. When someone does write about something like this, I think a lot of people interpret it as permission to share their own experience, as a license to unburden themselves. And I've heard a lot of very, very personal stories since from other people, things I would never have suspected, things that seem infinitely worse than the experience that I underwent, which have reminded me of just how much people can reconcile themselves to carrying in this life.
Yeah, you said it's selfish, but it's also, I think, a necessary part of, I guess, working through these kinds of things, that people who have undergone trauma want to hear about other people's experience as well, and that helps them work through their own trauma. So you mentioned a lot of people are now speaking with you, and we've had this similar conversations with other authors as well. Like the floodgates open.
I remember speaking to Rosie Betty about that actually, and how this kind of event can be quite overwhelming because people just feel the need to come and share their story with you.
Yeah.
That shared experience, but I mean, some might call it trauma dumping, I suppose, but it invites people, as you say, to share their own experience. Mm. So is that something you would encounter here at a writer's festival, for example, people sharing with you?
The book came out, I think, about a year ago, and yes, a lot of people have filled my email inbox with their own stories. People have come up to me at festivals like this. It's fair to say that when I wrote it, I did not have that fate in mind. Mm. And in fact, some part of me is a little bit reluctant to embrace this idea that I'm the grief guy because I don't think I have a particular insight into it. I don't think I have a particularly fresh take on it. I don't think I have any particular skills in the matter. I don't think I can provide solace for people. That's something that you can only do for yourself. But certainly a lot of people have said that the book has helped them and that they felt cathartic. It's a very short book, so it's very intense. It's very concentrated. It's quite demanding, I think. It's something that you can read in, 30 to 45 minutes, I think. Mm. It's certainly not a book that I have any desire to expand on or to build on. And this will be the one memoir I write, but there won't be any more.
That sounds like famous last words, but
No, I don't actually find myself all that interesting. Now, I'm a journalist. I've been a journalist for 42 years. Other people's stories have always struck me as infinitely more interesting than mine.
Mm.
But this was one story that I really felt as though I had to get to the bottom of, because it is formative.
Mm.
It does contribute significantly to a person's makeup when they lose a sibling.
Mm.
I think we underestimate it slightly, the importance of the loss of a sibling. We tend to think first of all as grief arising from the loss of partners or from the loss of children.
Mm.
Siblings are special.
Mm.
So they're not replaceable. They're unique in the sense that they share our DNA exactly. They often share a huge proportion of our formative experiences.
Mm.
All the friends in the world won't make up for the loss. Mm. I've been very, very fortunate in my friends in this life, but I have felt a deep loss from the lack of that kind of that emotional and
like an
spiritual
anchor.
Counterweight.
So you mentioned your journalistic career, and before we started recording, you mentioned that you've written 52 books.
Yeah.
So tell us about some of these other stories that have been interesting you.
Well, I've written a lot about cricket.
All right.
That's probably the means by which most people know me. I love cricket. I still play cricket. I think probably 30-odd of my books have been concerned with cricket in all its different dimensions. I tend to think of my career, such as it is, it's pretty chaotic, as being kind of knowing a lot about a little and a little about a lot. Yeah. I know a lot about cricket, too much, really, for any one person. But I've written about lots of other things, and I have, as a result, a concentration of knowledge about some fairly widely spaced topics interspersed with huge vistas of ignorance.
So what's fascinated you about cricket? Has it been the characters, the people who play the game?
Well, mostly. It's one of those sports that has a huge number of layers and it can be consumed and related to in myriad different ways. I started off because I'm a player.
Yeah.
I love playing and I still play. But it's integral, I think, to Australian life. It's still our number one national game. It's our longest-lived national team. It predated Australia as an idea. We had an Australian cricket team before we had an Australian nation. I think it says quite a lot about nationhood and a lot about national self-image and a lot about our relationship to our imperial overlords. I think it says a lot about community at the same time because, it's a lot of cricket is nurtured at the grassroots level by volunteers. By, you know, one of the first things you did when you established a town or a new community was you formed a cricket team. You built a cricket ground. It's a complex sport. It requires a lot of preparation, a lot of organisation. That calls forth skills that are valuable as citizens, as participants in a democracy. I've always thought it was very interesting that I think that the majority of the men involved in federation had relationship to cricket at some community or colonial level. You know, our first Prime Minister, Edmund Barton, was a cricket umpire, was a vice president of the New South Wales Cricket Association. So there's an economic and a commercial aspect to cricket that's very important now. In a sense, we're in the process of privatising cricket. We're turning it from something that we thought we owned into something that we're being sold, which I think is a development that people are inclined to overlook.
What do you mean by that?
Well, the advent of private ownership in cricket, I think, is coming, whether we're ready for it or not. It's already come in a huge way to India, which has mobilised enormous billions of capital and enormous, you know, billions of eyeballs. It'll come to Australia in the next few years.
Well, commercialisation has that ability to destroy the soul of something.
Absolutely. Yeah. More and more people are looking upon cricket as something that they can make money from rather than making money in order to afford cricket. It's an arena of profit as well as surplus.
But you're talking about all the political implications in the history of cricket, but as a huge cricket fan, you must also just be a stats nerd, right?
I love stats. I love stats and I love technique. Because I still play, I'm fascinated by the techniques of the game, the evolution of techniques of the game over the last 150 years. Cricket is a game that is constantly changing and mutating and taking on different forms, but also tapping into a traditional repertoire of skills at the same time. So it's a fascinating game to watch. The cricketers have turned from players of the sport to athletes in their own right. But at a certain level too, it's one of those games where you meet someone who's enthusiastic about cricket, no matter from what walk of life they are, from what ethnic or religious or intellectual background, and you already have an enormous amount in common with them. It's a kind of an Esperanto. And it means that Australians, whether they like it or not, have a huge amount in common with Indians, for instance. It's not a country that they would automatically feel as though they had a sympathy or a relationship to, but you know, you walk into India as an Australian and first thing they want to know about you is what to think about cricket.
I actually personally believe that we have a lot more in common with India than most people realise. Culturally, just as a sensibility, more so than maybe the detail of the food, for example, but more on that level of, I mean, the colonial.
I was going to say the shared history.
I think just probably as a people, as a cultural attitude to yourselves and that sort of thing as well.
I felt very at home in India when I first visited. It was almost like, you know, these are my people. You can have conversations about cricket in India that you would feel self-conscious about having in Australia. It would be too serious, even for Indians have a earnestness where cricket's concerned. It's quite delightful.
Yeah, and so the thing that we share with you is the fact that you've also got a podcast and it happens to be about cricket. Tell us a little bit about the podcast.
Okay, well, I'm a journalist for a long time, but in 2021, I think, I was at The Australian at that time, and I started off doing a cricket podcast with my colleague Peter Lawler called Cricket Etc. We then left The Australian and we reunited as a podcast called Cricket Et Al, which you'll find on YouTube, Spotify and Apple. And we also have a Substack called Cricket Et Al, where we write more or less every day on some sort of cricket and non-cricket related subject too. Because we're both kind of, you know, we've spent a long time working together, and we have similarly eclectic cultural interests. So write about all sorts of things.
So you're incredibly prolific, clearly. You just can't stop.
Yeah.
So when I found you in the room just now, in the green room here, you were writing.
I'm rough hewing a first draft of my next book at the moment.
Tell us about your next book.
I'm a bit superstitious. I'm to myself.
Fair enough.
Is it about cricket?
No, long way removed from cricket.
Baseball.
True crime is one of my fascinations, because I think that interesting crimes are a useful aperture through which to view the society in which they're committed. And I've written 3 or 4 true crime books, and they're also... They're actually histories with a crime in them, rather than being sort of grand guignol or sort of macabre. I find them fascinating.
They're deeply fascinating. I mean, we've been having this discussion because I'm fascinated by true crime. I mean, I'm a middle-aged woman. I think that comes with the territory, maybe. But it just doesn't connect with it on that same level. But I share your view that it's deeply interesting. It's a human story.
Yes.
And there's a lot more to it. It's not really even about the crime necessarily. No. It's about how we got there and what happened next.
Well, it certainly doesn't need to be about that. The crime doesn't need to actually be central. Crime is kind of like this lightning bolt that illuminates everything around.
Exactly. Interesting to hear you describe it like that. I think, that's how I feel. I guess I've found it hard to articulate, because people who aren't interested in true crime might see it as this kind of sick interest and I'm not saying that's how you feel, Ed, but it's not that. It's a human, it's like an empathy thing almost.
Well, I think the best of it is, I mean, it's certainly, there's sort of prurient and voyeuristic true crime, and that's kind of cynical and exploitative, but it doesn't have to be like that. In the same way as, crime fiction can attain the levels of the best sort of fiction, so true crime can resonate with the best of history.
I agree. So your book, My Brother Jazz, is available for sale now?
It is, published by Melbourne University Publishing. It's very beautiful, actually. They did a lovely job of producing it. And, my brother only lived for 17 years. He died in 1987. It sort of devastated our family and left a huge gap in it. But as my mother said recently, it is nice to have something of my brother after all these years. It's something more tangible than, a seat or a scholarship, or there's something of him in that book in some respects. We've been reunited by the experience of writing.
And I imagine there's something of him in each of you as well.
Yeah. I've still got artifacts of his that I regard as very precious. And, there is a huge community of loss out there as well that is often waiting just for you to scratch the surface.
Well, I'm so glad that you did, and I'm so glad that you felt able to share your story with the world and with us today. So thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And best of luck on your panel.
Thank you.
This has been a special presentation of the Not Quite Right podcast in collaboration with Words on the Waves Writers Festival. Check the show notes for more information about Words on the Waves and the books mentioned in this episode. If you're new to the podcast, please join us again for our regular episodes where we talk about media, culture, and the art of writing. Something that is seeming quite right.